This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents On Killing: The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. Written and read by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman.
Dedication. Not of the princes and prelates with heroic charioteers, riding triumphantly laureled to lap the fat of the years. Rather the scorned, the rejected, the men hemmed in with spears. The man in tattered battalion which fights till it dies, dazed with the dust of the battle, the din of the cries. The men with the broken heads and the blood running into their eyes. Not the bemedaled commander beloved of the throne, riding cock horse to parade when the bugles are blown, but the lads who carried the hill and cannot be known. Others may sing of the wine and the wealth and the mirth, the portly presence of potentates goodly in girth. Mine be the dirt and the dross, the dust that's come of the earth. Theirs be the music, the color, the glory, the gold. Mine be a handful of ashes, a mouthful of mold. Of the maimed, of the halt, and the blind, and the rain, and the cold. Of these shall my songs be fashioned, my tale be told. Amen. John Masefield, A Consecration. Introduction. Killing in Science, On Dangerous Ground. Quote, "This is the time of year when people would slaughter. Back when people did that. Raleigh and Eunice Hochstetter, I think, were the last in Lake Wobegon. They kept pigs. They'd slaughter them in the fall when the weather got cold and the meat would keep. I went out to see them slaughter hogs once when I was a kid, along with my cousin and my uncle, who was going to help Raleigh. Today, if you are going to slaughter an animal for meat, you send it into the locker plant and pay to have the guys there do it. When you slaughter pigs, it takes away your appetite for pork for a while, because the pigs let you know that they don't care for it. They don't care to be grabbed and dragged over to where the other pigs went and didn't come back." It was quite a thing for a kid to see. To see living flesh and the living insides of another creature. I expected to be disgusted by it, but I wasn't. I was fascinated. I got as close as I could. And I remember that my cousin and I sort of got carried away in the excitement of it all. And we went down to the pig pen and we started throwing little stones at pigs to watch them jump and squeal and run. And all of a sudden I felt a big hand on my shoulder, and I was spun around, and my uncle's face was 3 inches away from mine. He said, "If I ever see you do that again, I'll beat you till you can't stand up. You hear?" And we heard. I knew at the time that his anger had to do with the slaughter, that it was a ritual, and it was done as a ritual. It was done swiftly, and there was no foolishness, no joking around, very little conversation. People went about their jobs, men and women, knowing exactly what to do, and always with respect for the animals that would become our food. And our throwing stones at pigs violated this ceremony and this ritual, which they went through. Raleigh was the last one to slaughter his own hogs. One year he had an accident. The knife slipped, and an animal that was only wounded got loose and ran across the yard before it fell. He never kept pigs after that. He didn't feel he was worthy of it. It's all gone. Children growing up in Lake Wobegon will never have a chance to see it. It was a powerful experience. Life and death hung in the balance. A life in which people made do, made their own, lived off the land, lived between the ground and God. It's lost, not only to this world, but also to memory. Garrison Keillor, Hog Slaughter. Why should we study killing? One might just as readily ask, why study sex? The two questions have much in common. Richard Heckler points out that it is in the mythological marriage of Ares and Aphrodite that harmonia is born. Peace will not come until we have mastered both sex and war. And to master war, we must study it with at least the diligence of Kinsey or Masters and Johnson. Every society has a blind spot, an area into which it has great difficulty looking. Today that blind spot is killing. A century ago, it was sex. For millennia, man sheltered himself and his family in caves or huts or one-room hovels. The whole extended family, grandparents, parents, and children, all huddled together around the warmth of a single fire, within the protection of a single wall. And for thousands of years, sex between a husband and wife could generally only take place at night, in the darkness, in this crowded central room. I once interviewed a woman who grew up in an American gypsy family, sleeping in a big communal tent with aunts, uncles, grandparents, parents, cousins, brothers, and sisters all around her. As a young child, sex was to her something funny, noisy, and slightly bothersome that grown-ups did in the night. In this environment, there were no private bedrooms. Until very recently in human history, for the average human being, there was no such luxury as a bedroom or even a bed. Although by today's sexual standards, this situation might seem awkward, it was not without its benefits. One advantage was that sexual abuse of children could not happen without at least the knowledge and tacit consent of the entire family. Another, less obvious benefit of this age-old living arrangement was that throughout the life cycle, from birth to death, sex was always before you, and no one could deny that it was a vital, essential, and not too mysterious aspect of daily human existence. And then, by the period that we know as the Victorian era, everything had changed. Suddenly, the average middle-class family lived in a multi-room dwelling. Children grew up having never witnessed the primal act. And suddenly, sex became hidden, private, mysterious, frightening, and dirty. The era of sexual repression in Western civilization had begun. In this repressed society, women were covered from neck to ankle, and even the furniture legs were covered with skirts, since the sight of these legs disturbed the delicate sensitivities of that era. Yet, at the same time that this society repressed sex, it appears to have become obsessed by it. Pornography as we know it blossomed. Child prostitution flourished. And a wave of sexual child abuse began to ripple down through the generations. Sex is a natural and essential part of life. A society that has no sex has no society in one generation. Today, our society has begun the slow, painful process of escaping from this pathological dichotomy of simultaneous sexual repression and obsession. But we may have begun our escape from one denial, only to fall into a new and possibly even more dangerous one. A new repression, revolving around killing and death, precisely parallels the pattern established by the previous sexual repression. Throughout history, man has been surrounded by close and personal death and killing. When family members died of disease, lingering injury, or old age, they died in the home. When they died anywhere close to home, their corpses were brought to the house or cave or hut or hovel and prepared for burial by the family. Places in the Heart is a movie in which Sally Field portrays a woman on a small cotton farm early in the 20th century. Her husband has been shot and killed and is brought to the house. And, repeating a ritual that has been enacted for countless centuries by countless millions of wives, she lovingly washes his naked corpse, preparing it for burial, as tears streak down her face. In that world, each family did its own killing and cleaning of domestic animals. Death was a part of life. Killing was undeniably essential to living. Cruelty was seldom, if ever, a part of this killing. Mankind understood its place in life and respected the place of the creatures whose deaths were required to perpetuate existence. The American Indian asked forgiveness of the spirit of the deer he killed, and the American farmer respected the dignity of the hogs he slaughtered. As Garrison Keillor records in Hog Slaughter, the slaughter of animals has been a vital ritual of daily and seasonal activity for most people until the last half century of human existence. Despite the rise of the city, by the opening of the 20th century, the majority of the population, even in the most advanced industrial societies, remained rural. The housewife who wanted a chicken dinner went out and wrung the chicken's neck herself, or had her children do it. The children watched the daily and seasonal killings, and to them, killing was a serious, messy, and slightly boring thing that everyone did as a part of life. In this environment, there was no refrigeration and few slaughterhouses, mortuaries, or hospitals. And in this age-old living arrangement, throughout the life cycle, from birth to death, death and killing were always before you, either as a participant or a bored spectator, and no one could deny that it was a vital, essential, and common aspect of daily human existence. And then, in just the last few generations, everything began to change. Slaughterhouses and refrigeration insulated us from the necessity of killing our own food animals. Modern medicine began to cure diseases, and it became increasingly rare for us to die in the youth and prime of our lives. And nursing homes, hospitals, and mortuaries insulated us from the death of the elderly. Children began to grow up having never truly understood where their food came from. And suddenly Western civilization seemed to have decided that killing anything at all, was increasingly hidden, private, mysterious, frightening, and dirty. The impact of this ranges from the trivial to the bizarre. Just as the Victorians put skirts around their furniture to hide the legs, now mousetraps come equipped with covers to hide the killer's handiwork. And laboratories conducting medical research with animals are broken into, and life-saving research is destroyed by animal rights activists. These activists, while partaking of the medical fruits of their society, fruits based upon centuries of animal research, attack researchers. Chris DeRose, head of the Los Angeles-based activist group Last Chance for Animals, says, "If the death of one rat cured all diseases, it wouldn't make any difference to me. In the scheme of life, we're equal." Any killing offends this new sensibility. People wearing fur or leather coats are verbally and physically attacked. In this new order, people are condemned as racist or specious and murderers when they eat meat. Animal rights leader Ingrid Newkirk says, "A rat is a pig is a boy," and compares the killing of chickens to the Nazi Holocaust. 6 million people died in concentration camps, she told the Washington Post, but 6 billion broiler chickens will die this year in slaughterhouses. Yet, at the same time that our society represses killing, a new obsession with the depiction of violent and brutal death and dismemberment of humans has flourished. The public appetite for violence in movies, particularly in splatter movies, such as Natural Born Killers, Kill Bill, Saw, Friday the 13th, Halloween, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the cult status of heroes like Jason, Freddy, and Hannibal the Cannibal, the popularity of bands with names like Megadeth and Guns N' Roses, and skyrocketing murder and violent crime rates. All these are symptoms of a bizarre pathological dichotomy of simultaneous repression and obsession with violence. Sex and death are natural and essential parts of life. Just as a society without sex would disappear in a generation, so too would a society without killing. Every major city in our nation must exterminate millions of rats and mice each year or become uninhabitable. Our granaries and grain elevators must exterminate millions of rats and mice each year. If they fail to do this, instead of being the world's breadbasket, the United States would be unable to feed itself, and millions of people around the world would face starvation. Certain genteel sensitivities of the Victorian era are not without value and benefit to our society, and few would argue for a return to communal sleeping arrangements. In the same way, those who hold and espouse modern sensitivities about killing are generally gentle and sincere human beings, who in many ways represent the most idealistic characteristic of our species, and their concerns have great value once we bring them into perspective. As technology enables us to butcher and exterminate whole species, including our own, it is vital that we learn restraint and self-discipline. But we must also remember that death has its place in the natural order of life. It seems that when a society does not have natural processes, such as sex, death, and killing, before it, that society will respond by denying and warping that aspect of nature. As our technology insulates us from a specific aspect of reality, our societal response seems to be to slip deep into bizarre dreams about that which we flee. Dreams spun from the fantasy stuff of denial. Dreams that can become dangerous societal nightmares as we sink deeper into the tempting web of fantasy. Today, even as we waken from the nightmare of sexual repression, Our society is beginning to sink into a new denial dream, that of violence and horror. This book is an attempt to bring the objective light of scientific scrutiny into the process of killing. A.M. Rosenthal tells us, "The health of humankind is not measured just by its coughs and wheezes, but by the fevers of its soul. Or perhaps more important yet, by the quickness and care we bring against them." If our history suggests unreason's durability, our experience teaches that to neglect it is to indulge it, and that to indulge it is to prepare hate's triumph. To neglect it is to indulge it. This is, therefore, a study of aggression, a study of violence, and a study of killing. Most specifically, it is an attempt to conduct a scientific study of the act of killing within the Western way of war, and of the psychological and sociological processes and prices exacted when men kill each other in combat. Sheldon Bidwell held that such a study would, by its very nature, lay on dangerous ground because the union between soldier and scientist has not yet passed beyond flirtation. I would seek to go in harm's way and effect not just a serious union between soldier and scientist, but a tentative ménage à trois between soldier, scientist, and historian. I have combined these skills to conduct a 5-year program of research into the previously taboo topic of killing in combat. In this study, it is my intention to delve into this taboo subject of killing and to provide insight into the following: the existence of a powerful innate human resistance toward killing one's own species and the psychological mechanisms that have been developed by armies over the centuries to overcome that resistance. The role of atrocity in war, and the mechanisms by which armies are both empowered and entrapped by atrocity. What it feels like to kill, a set of standard response stages to killing in combat, and the psychological price of killing. The techniques that have been developed and applied with tremendous success in modern combat training in order to condition soldiers to overcome their resistance to killing. How the American soldier in Vietnam was first psychologically enabled to kill to a far greater degree than any other soldier in previous history, then denied the psychologically essential purification ritual that exists in every warrior society, and finally condemned and accused by his own society to a degree that is unprecedented in Western history, and the terrible tragic price that America's 3 million Vietnam veterans, their families, and our society are paying for what we did to our soldiers in Vietnam. Finally, and perhaps most important, I believe that this study will provide insight into the way that rifts in our society combine with violence in the media and in interactive video games to indiscriminately condition our nation's children to kill in a fashion very similar to the way the Army conditions our soldiers, but without the safeguards. And we will see the terrible, tragic price that our nation is paying for what we are doing to our children. A personal note. I am a soldier of 24 years' service. I have been a sergeant in the 82nd Airborne Division, a platoon leader in the 9th High-Tech Testbed Division, and I have been a general staff officer and a company commander in the 7th Light Infantry Division. I'm a parachute infantryman and an Army Ranger. I have been deployed to the Arctic tundras, the Central American jungles, NATO headquarters, the Warsaw Pact, and countless mountains and deserts. I'm a graduate of military schools ranging from the 18th Airborne Corps NCO Academy to the British Army Staff College. I graduated summa cum laude from my undergraduate training as a historian and Kappa Delta Pi from my graduate training as a psychologist. I have had the privilege of being a co-speaker with General Westmoreland before the national leadership of the Vietnam Veterans Coalition of America, and I have served as a keynote speaker to the 6th Annual Convention of the Vietnam Veterans of America. I have served in academic positions ranging from a junior high school counselor to a West Point psychology professor, and I have served as the professor of military science and chair of the Department of Military Science at Arkansas State University. But for all this experience, I, like Richard Holmes and John Keegan, Patty Griffith, and many others who have gone before me in this field, have not killed in combat. Perhaps I could not be as dispassionate and objective as I need to be if I had to carry the load of emotional pain myself. But the men whose words filled this study have killed. Very often, what they shared with me was something that they had never shared with anyone before. As a counselor, I have been taught, and I hold it to be a fundamental truth of human nature, that when someone withholds something traumatic, it can cause great damage. When you share something with someone, it helps to place it in perspective. But when you hold it inside, as one of my psychology students once put it, it eats you alive from the inside out. Furthermore, there is great therapeutic value in the catharsis that comes with lancing these emotional boils. The essence of counseling is that pain shared is pain divided, and there was much pain shared during these periods. The ultimate objective of this book is to uncover the dynamics of killing. But my prime motivation has been to help pierce the taboo of killing that prevented these men and many millions like them from sharing their pain. And then to use the knowledge gained in order to understand first the mechanisms that enable war, and then the cause of the current wave of violent crime that is destroying our nation. If I have succeeded, it is because of the help given to me by these men whose tales are told herein. Many copies of early drafts of this work had circulated among the Vietnam veterans community for years prior to the initial publication of this book, and many veterans carefully edited and commented on those drafts. Many of these vets read this book and shared it with their spouses. Then those wives shared it with other wives, and these wives shared it with their husbands, and so on. Many times the veterans and or their wives contacted me and let me know how they were able to use this book to communicate and understand what had happened in combat. Out of their pain has come understanding, and out of that understanding has come the power to heal lives and perhaps to heal a nation that is being consumed with violence. These men whose personal narratives appear in this study are noble and brave men who trusted others with their experiences in order to contribute to the body of human knowledge. Many killed in combat, but they killed to save their lives and the lives of their comrades, and my admiration and affection for them and their brothers is very real. John Masefield's poem, A Consecration, serves as a better dedication than any I could write. The exception to this admiration is, of course, addressed in the section entitled Killing and Atrocities. If in my absence of euphemisms, and my effort to clearly and clinically speak of killers and victims, if in these things the reader senses moral judgment or disapproval of the individuals involved, let me flatly and categorically deny it. Generations of Americans have endured great physical and psychological trauma and horror in order to give us our freedoms. Men such as those quoted in my study followed Washington, stood shoulder to shoulder with Crockett and Travis at the Alamo, righted the great wrong of slavery, and stopped the murderous evil of Hitler. They answered their nation's call and heeded not the cost. As a soldier of nearly a quarter century of service, I take pride in having maintained in some small way the standard of sacrifice and dedication represented by these men, and I would not harm them or besmirch their memory and honor. Douglas MacArthur said it well. However horrible the incidents of war may be, the soldier who is called upon to offer and give his life for his country is the noblest development of mankind. These soldiers whose narratives form the heart and soul of this work understand the essence of war. They are heroes, as great as any found in the Iliad. Yet the words that you will read here, their own words, destroy the myth of warriors and war as heroic. The soldier understands that there are times when all others have failed, and that then he must pay the butcher's bill and fight, suffer, and die to undo the errors of politicians and to fulfill the will of the people. The soldier above all other people, said MacArthur, prays for peace, for they must suffer and bear the deepest wounds and scars of war. There is wisdom in the words of these soldiers. There is wisdom in these tales of a handful of ashes and a mouthful of mold, of the maimed, of the halt, and the blind, and the rain, and the cold. There is wisdom here, and we would do well to listen. Just as I do not wish to condemn those who have killed in lawful combat, nor do I wish to judge the many soldiers who chose not to kill. There are many such soldiers. Indeed, I will provide evidence that in many historical circumstances, these non-firers represented the majority of those in the firing line. As a soldier who may have stood beside them, I cannot help but be dismayed at their failure to support their cause, their nation, and their fellows. But as a human being who has understood some of the burden that they have borne and the sacrifice that they have made, I cannot help but be proud of them and the noble characteristic that they represent in our species. The subject of killing makes most healthy people uneasy, and some of the specific subjects and areas to be addressed here will be repulsive and offensive. They are things that we would rather turn away from, but Karl von Clausewitz warned that it is to no purpose, it is even against one's better interest, to turn away from the consideration of the affair because the horror of its elements excites repugnance. Brunel Bettelheim, a survivor of the Nazi death camps, argues that the root of our failure to deal with violence lies in our refusal to face up to it. We deny our fascination with the dark beauty of violence, and we condemn aggression and repress it rather than look at it squarely and try to understand and control it. And finally, if in my focus on the pain of the killers I do not sufficiently address the suffering of the victims, let me apologize now. The guy pulling the trigger, wrote Alan Cole and Chris Bunch, never suffers as much as the person on the receiving end. It is the existence of the victim's pain and loss, echoing forever in the soul of the killer, that is at the heart of his pain. Leo Frankowski tells us that cultures all develop blind spots, things that they don't even think about, because they know the truth about them. The veterans quoted in this study have had their faces rubbed in this cultural blind spot. We are truly, as one veteran put it to me, virgins studying sex, but they can teach us what they have learned at such a dear price. My objective is to understand the psychological nature of killing in combat and to probe the emotional wounds and scars of these men who answered their nation's call and meted out death or chose to pay the price for not doing so. Now more than ever, we must overcome our revulsion and understand, as we have never understood before, why it is that men fight and kill, and equally important, why it is that they will not. Only on the basis of understanding this ultimate destructive aspect of human behavior can we hope to influence it in such a way as to ensure the survival of our civilization. Section 1. Killing and the Existence of the Resistance. A World of Virgins Studying Sex. Quote, "It is therefore reasonable to believe that the average and healthy individual, a man who can endure the mental and physical stresses of combat, still has such an inner and usually unrealized resistance towards killing a fellow man that he will not of his own volition take life if it is possible to turn away from that responsibility. At the vital point, he becomes a conscientious objector." S.L.A. Marshall, Men Against Fire. Quote, "Then I cautiously raised the upper half of my body into the tunnel until I was lying flat on my stomach. When I felt comfortable, I placed my Smith & Wesson 38 caliber snubnose, sent to me by my father for tunnel work, beside the flashlight, and switched on the light, illuminating the tunnel. There, not more than 15 feet away, sat a Viet Cong, eating a handful of rice from a pouch on his lap. We looked at each other for what seemed to be an eternity, but in fact was probably only a few seconds. Maybe it was the surprise of actually finding someone else there, or maybe it was just the absolute innocence of the situation, but neither one of us reacted. After a moment, he put his pouch of rice on the floor of the tunnel beside him, turned his back to me, and slowly started crawling away. I, in turn, switched off my flashlight before slipping back into the lower tunnel and making my way back to the entrance. About 20 minutes later, we received word that another squad had killed a VC emerging from a tunnel 500 meters away. To this day, I firmly believe that Grunt and I could have ended the war sooner over a beer in Saigon than Henry Kissinger ever could by attending the peace talks. Michael Kaufman, Triangle Tunnel Rat." Our first step in the study of killing is to understand the existence, extent, and nature of the average human being's resistance to killing his fellow human, In this section, we will attempt to do that. When I started interviewing combat veterans as a part of this study, I discussed some of the psychological theories concerning the trauma of combat with one crusty old sergeant. He laughed scornfully and said, "Those bastards don't know anything about it. They're like a world of virgins studying sex, and they got nothing to go on but porno movies." And it is just like sex, because the people who really do it just don't talk about it. In a way, the study of killing in combat is very much like the study of sex. Killing is a private, intimate occurrence of tremendous intensity, in which the destructive act becomes psychologically very much like the procreative act. For those who've never experienced it, the depiction of battle that Hollywood has given us and the cultural mythology that Hollywood is based upon appear to be about as useful in understanding killing as pornographic movies would be in trying to understand the intimacy of a sexual relationship. A virgin observer might get the mechanics of sex right by watching the X-rated movie, but he or she would never hope to understand the intimacy and intensity of the procreative experience. As a society, we are as fascinated by killing as we are by sex, possibly more so, since we are somewhat jaded by sex and have a fairly broad base of individual experience in this area. Many children, upon seeing that I am a decorated soldier, immediately ask, "Have you ever killed anyone? Or how many people have you killed?" Where does this curiosity come from? Robert Heinlein once wrote that fulfillment in life involved loving a good woman and killing a bad man. If there is such a strong interest in killing in our society, and if it equates in many minds to an act of manhood equivalent to sex, then why hasn't the destructive act been as specifically and systematically studied as the procreative act? Over the centuries, there have been a few pioneers who have laid the foundation for such a study, and in this section we will attempt to look at them all. Probably the best starting point is with S.L.A. Marshall, the greatest and most influential of these pioneers. Prior to World War II, it had always been assumed that the average soldier would kill in combat, simply because his country and his leaders have told him to do so and because it is essential to defend his own life and the lives of his friends. When the point came that he didn't kill, it was assumed that he would panic and run. During World War II, U.S. Army Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall asked the average soldiers what it was that they did in battle. His singularly unexpected discovery was that of every 100 men along the line of fire during the period of an encounter, an average of only 15 to 20, would take any part with their weapons. This was consistently true, whether the action was spread over a day or 2 days or three. Marshall was a U.S. Army historian in the Pacific Theater during World War II, and later became the official U.S. historian of the European Theater of Operations. He had a team of historians working for him, and they based their findings on individual and mass interviews with thousands of soldiers and more than 400 infantry companies in Europe and in the Pacific, immediately after they had been in close combat with German or Japanese troops. The results were consistently the same. Only 15 to 20% of the American riflemen in combat during World War II would fire at the enemy. Those who would not fire did not run or hide. In many cases, they were willing to risk great danger to rescue comrades, get ammunition, or run messages. But they simply would not fire their weapons at the enemy, even when faced with repeated waves of bonsai charges. The question is why? Why did these men fail to fire? As I examined this question and studied the process of killing in combat from the standpoints of a historian, a psychologist, and a soldier, I began to understand that there was one major factor that was missing in the common understanding of killing in combat, a factor that answers this question and more. That missing factor is the simple and demonstrable fact that there is within most men an intense resistance to killing their fellow man. A resistance so strong that, in many circumstances, soldiers on the battlefield would die before they can overcome it. To some, this makes obvious sense. "Of course it's hard to kill someone," they would say. "I could never bring myself to do it," but they would be wrong. With the proper conditioning and the proper circumstances, it appears that almost anyone can and will kill. Others might respond, "Any man will kill in combat when he is faced with someone who is trying to kill him." And they would be even more wrong. For in this section, we shall observe that throughout history, the majority of men on the battlefield would not attempt to kill the enemy, even to save their own lives or the lives of their friends. Chapter 1, Fight or Flight, Posture or Submit. Quote, "The notion that the only alternatives to conflict are fight or flight is embedded in our culture, and our educational institutions have done little to challenge it. The traditional American military policy raises it to the level of a law of nature." Richard Heckler, In Search of the Warrior Spirit. One of the roots of our misunderstanding of the psychology of the battlefield lies in the misapplication of the fight-or-flight model to the stresses of combat. This model holds that in the face of danger, a series of physiological and psychological processes prepare and support the endangered creature for the fighting or fleeing. The fight-or-flight dichotomy is the appropriate set of choices for any creature faced with danger other than that which comes from his own species. When we examine the responses of creatures confronted with aggression from their own species, the set of options expands to include posturing and submission. This application of animal kingdom intraspecies response patterns, that is, fight, flee, posture, and submit, to human warfare is, to the best of my knowledge, entirely new. The first decision point in an intraspecies conflict usually involves deciding between fleeing or posturing. A threatened baboon or rooster who elects to stand its ground does not respond to aggression from one of its own kind by leaping instantly to the enemy's throat. Instead, both creatures instinctively go through a series of posturing actions that, while intimidating, are almost always harmless. These actions are designed to convince an opponent, through both sight and sound, that the posturer is a dangerous and frightening adversary. When the posturer has failed to dissuade an intraspecies opponent, the options then become fight, flight, or submission. When the fight option is utilized, it is almost never to the death. Conrad Lorenz pointed out that piranhas and rattlesnakes will bite anything and everything, but among themselves, piranha fight with wraps of their tails, and rattlesnakes wrestle. Somewhere during the course of such highly constrained and non-lethal fights, one of these intraspecies opponents will usually become daunted by the ferocity and prowess of its opponent, and its only option becomes submission or flight. Submission is a surprisingly common response, usually taking the form of fawning and exposing some vulnerable point of the anatomy to the victor, in the instinctive knowledge that the opponent will not kill or further harm one of its own kind once it has surrendered. The posturing, mock battle, and submission process is vital to the survival of the species. It prevents needless deaths and ensures that a young male will live through early confrontations when his opponents are bigger and better prepared. Having been out-postured by his opponent, he can then submit and live to mate, passing on his genes in later years. There is a clear distinction between actual violence and posturing. Oxford social psychologist Peter Marsh notes that this is true in New York street gangs. It is true in so-called primitive tribesmen and warriors. And it is true in almost any culture in the world. All have the same patterns of aggression, and all have highly orchestrated, highly ritualized patterns of posturing, mock battle, and submission. These rituals restrain and focus the violence on relatively harmless posturing and display. What is created is a perfect illusion of violence. Aggression, yes. Competitiveness, yes. But only a very tiny, tiny level of actual violence. There is, concludes Gwen Dyer, the occasional sociopath who really wants to slice people open. But most of the participants are really interested in status, display, profit, and damage limitation. Like their peacetime contemporaries, the kids who have fought in close combat throughout history, and it is kids or adolescent males, whom most societies traditionally send off to do their fighting. Killing the enemy was the very least of their intentions. In war, as in gang war, posturing is the name of the game. In this account from Patty Griffith's Battle Tactics of the Civil War, we can see the effective use of verbal posturing in the thick woods of the American Civil War's wilderness campaign. The yellers could not be seen, and a company could make itself sound like a regiment if it shouted loud enough. Men spoke later of various units on both sides being yelled out of their positions. In such instances of units being yelled out of positions, we see posturing in its most successful form, resulting in the opponent's selection of the flight option without even attempting the fight option. adding the posture and submission options to the standard fight-or-flight model of aggression response helps to explain many of the actions on the battlefield. When a man is frightened, he literally stops thinking with his forebrain, that is, with the mind of a human being, and begins to think with the midbrain, that is, with the portion of the brain that is essentially indistinguishable from that of an animal. And in the mind of an animal, it is the one who makes the loudest noise or puffs himself up the largest who will win. Posturing can be seen in the plumed helmets of the ancient Greeks and Romans, which allowed the bearer to appear taller and therefore fiercer to his foe, while the brilliantly shined armor made him seem broader and brighter. Such plumage saw its height in modern warfare during the Napoleonic era, when soldiers wore bright uniforms and high, uncomfortable shako hats, which served no purpose other than to make the wearer look and feel like a taller, more dangerous creature. In the same manner, the roars of two posturing beasts are exhibited by the men in battle. For centuries, the war cries of soldiers have made their opponents' blood run cold. Whether it be the battle cry of a Greek phalanx, the hurrah of the Russian infantry, the wail of Scottish bagpipes, or the rebel yell of our own civil war, soldiers have always instinctively sought to daunt the enemy through nonviolent means prior to physical conflict, while encouraging one another and impressing themselves with their own ferocity and simultaneously providing a very effective means of drowning out the disagreeable yell of the enemy. A modern equivalent of the Civil War occurrence mentioned above can be seen in the Army Historical Series account of a French battalion's participation in the defense of Chipyong-ni during the Korean War. The North Korean soldiers formed 100 to 200 yards in front of the small hill, which the French occupied, then launched their attack, blowing whistles and bugles and running with bayonets fixed. When this noise started, the French soldiers began cranking a hand siren they had, and one squad started running toward the Chinese, yelling and throwing grenades far to the front and to the side. When the two forces were within 20 yards of each other, the Chinese suddenly turned and ran in the opposite direction. It was all over within a minute. Here again we see an incident in which posturing, involving sirens, grenade explosions, and charging bayonets, by a small force was sufficient to cause a numerically superior enemy force to hastily select the flight option. With the advent of gunpowder, the soldier has been provided with one of the finest possible means of posturing. Time and again, says Patty Griffith, we read of regiments in the Civil War blazing away uncontrollably, once started and continuing until all ammunition was gone or all enthusiasm spent. Firing was such a positive act and gave the men such a physical release for their emotions that instincts easily took over from training and from the exhortations of officers. Gunpowder's superior noise, its superior posturing ability, made it ascendant on the battlefield. The longbow would still have been used in the Napoleonic Wars if the raw mathematics of killing effectiveness was all that mattered, since both the longbow's firing rate and its accuracy were much greater than that of a smoothbore musket. But a frightened man, thinking with his midbrain and going ploink, ploink, ploink with a bow, doesn't stand a chance against an equally frightened man going bang, bang with a musket. Firing a musket or rifle clearly fills the deep-seated need to posture, and it even meets the requirement of being relatively harmless when we consider the consistent historical occurrences of firing over the enemy's head and the remarkable ineffectiveness of such fire. Ardan Tupik became one of the first to document the common tendency of soldiers to fire harmlessly into the air, simply for the sake of firing. Tupik made one of the first thorough investigations into the nature of combat with a questionnaire distributed to French officers in the 1860s. One officer's response to Tupik stated quite frankly that a good many soldiers fired into the air at long distances, while another observed that a certain number of our soldiers fired almost in the air, without aiming, seeming to want to stun themselves to become drunk on rifle fire during this gripping crisis. Patty Griffith joins Dupique in observing that soldiers in battle have a desperate urge to fire their weapons, even when, perhaps especially when, they cannot possibly do the enemy any harm. Griffith notes, even in the noted slaughter pens of Bloody Lane, Mary's Heights, Kennesaw, Spotsylvania, and Cold Harbor, an attacking unit could not only come very close to the defending line, but it could also stay there for hours, and indeed for days at a time. Civil War musketry did not, therefore, possess the power to kill large numbers of men, even in very dense formations at long range. At short range, it could and did kill large numbers, but not very quickly. Griffith estimates that the average musket fire from a Napoleonic or Civil War regiment, usually numbering between 200 and 1,000 men, firing at an exposed enemy regiment at an average range of 30 yards, would usually result in hitting only one or two men per minute. Such firefights dragged on until exhaustion set in or nightfall put an end to the hostilities. Casualties mounted because the contest went on so long, not because the fire was particularly deadly. Thus we see that the fire of the Napoleonic and Civil War era soldier was incredibly ineffective. This does not represent a failure on the part of the weaponry. John Keegan and Richard Holmes, in their book Soldiers, tell us of a Prussian experiment in the late 1700s, in which an infantry battalion fired smoothbore muskets at a target 100 feet long by 6 feet high, representing an enemy unit, which resulted in 25% hits at 225 yards, 40% hits at 150 yards, and 60% hits at 75 yards. This represents the potential killing power of such a unit. The reality is demonstrated at the Battle of Belgrade in 1717, when two Imperial battalions held their fire until their Turkish opponents were only 30 paces away, but hit only 32 Turks when they fired and were promptly overwhelmed. Sometimes the fire was completely harmless, as Benjamin McIntyre observed in his first-hand account of a totally bloodless nighttime firefight at Vicksburg in 1863. "It seems strange," wrote McIntyre, "that a company of men can fire volley after volley at a like number of men at not over a distance of 15 steps and not cause a single casualty. Yet such was the facts in this instance." The musketry of the black powder era was not always so ineffective, but over and over again, the average comes out to only one or two men hit per minute with musketry. Cannon fire, like machine gun fire in World War II, is an entirely different matter, sometimes accounting for more than 50% of the casualties on the black powder battlefield, and artillery fire has consistently accounted for the majority of combat casualties in the 20th century. This is largely due to the group processes at work in a cannon, machine gun, or other crew-served weapons firing. This subject is addressed in detail later in this book, in the section entitled An Anatomy of Killing. Muzzle-loading muskets could fire from 1 to 5 shots per minute, depending on the skill of the operator and the state of the weapon. With a potential hit rate of well over 50% of the average combat ranges of this era, the killing rate should have been hundreds per minute, instead of one or two. The weak link between the killing potential and the killing capability of these units was the soldier. The simple fact is that when faced with a living, breathing opponent instead of a target, a significant majority of the soldiers revert to a posturing mode in which they fire over their enemy's heads. Richard Holmes, in his superb book, Acts of War, examines the hit rates of soldiers in a variety of historical battles. At Rorke's Drift in 1897, a small group of British soldiers were surrounded and vastly outnumbered by the Zulu. Firing volley after volley into the massed enemy ranks at point-blank range, it seems as if no round could have possibly missed, and even a 50% hit rate would seem to be low. But Holmes estimates that in actuality, approximately 13 rounds were fired for each hit. In the same way, General Crook's men fired 25,000 rounds at Rosebud Creek on June 16, 1876, causing 99 casualties among the Indians, or 252 rounds per hit. And in the French defense from fortified positions during the Battle of Wissembourg in 1870, the French, shooting at German soldiers advancing across open fields, fired 48,000 rounds to hit 404 Germans. For a hit ratio of one hit per 119 rounds fired. And some, or possibly even the majority, of the casualties had to have been from artillery fire, which makes the French killing rate even more remarkable. Lieutenant George Ruppel encountered this same phenomenon while commanding a British platoon in World War I. He stated that the only way he could stop his men from firing into the air was to draw his sword and walk down the trench, beating the men on the backside, and, as I got their attention, telling them to fire low. And the trend can be found in the firefights of Vietnam, when more than 50,000 bullets were fired for every enemy soldier killed. One of the things that amazed me, stated Douglas Graham, a medic with the 1st Marine Division in Vietnam, who had to crawl out under enemy and friendly fire to aid wounded soldiers, is how many bullets can be fired during a firefight without anybody getting hurt. The focus of primitive tribesmen on posturing at the expense of fighting in times of war is usually blatant and obvious. Richard Gabriel points out that primitive New Guinea tribes were excellent shots with the bow and arrows they used while hunting. But when they went to war with each other, they took the feathers off the backs of their arrows. And it was only with these inaccurate and useless arrows that they fought their wars. In the same way, the American Indians considered counting coup, or simply touching their enemy, to be far more important than killing. This trend can be seen in the roots of the Western way of war. Sam Keen notes that Professor Arthur Nock at Harvard was fond of saying that wars between the Greek city-states were only slightly more dangerous than American football. And Ardan Toupique points out that in all his years of conquest, Alexander the Great lost only 700 men to the sword. His enemy lost many, many more, but almost all of this occurred after the battle, which appears to have been an almost bloodless pushing match, when the enemy soldiers had turned their backs and begun to run. Karl von Clausewitz makes this same point when he notes that the vast majority of combat losses historically occurred in the pursuit after one side or the other had won the battle. Why this occurs is a subject that will be looked at in detail in the section Killing and Physical Distance. As we shall see, modern training or conditioning techniques can partially overcome the inclination to posture. Indeed, the history of warfare can be seen as a history of increasingly more effective mechanisms for enabling and conditioning men to overcome their innate resistance to killing their fellow human beings. In many circumstances, highly trained modern soldiers have fought poorly trained guerrilla forces, and the tendency of poorly prepared forces to instinctively engage in posturing mechanisms, such as firing high, has given a significant advantage to the more highly trained force. Jack Thompson, a Rhodesian veteran, observed this process in combat against untrained forces. In Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, says Thompson, their immediate action drill was to shed our packs and assault into the fire, always. That was because the guerrillas were not able to deliver effective fire, and their bullets went high. We would quickly establish fire superiority and rarely ever lost a man. This psychological and technological superiority in training and killing enabling continues to be a vital factor in modern warfare. It can be seen in the British invasion of the Falklands and the 1989 United States invasion of Panama, where the tremendous success of the invaders and the remarkable disparity between the kill ratios can be at least partially explained by the degree and quality of training in the different forces. This can also be seen in the long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which U.S. and NATO forces had such a marked advantage in firefights that the enemy was only able to inflict casualties with IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, which were once known as booby traps. Missing the target does not necessarily involve firing obviously high. And 2 decades on Army rifle ranges have taught me that a soldier must fire unusually high for it to be obvious to an observer. In other words, the intentional miss can be a very subtle form of disobedience. One of the best examples of an intentional miss was the experience of my grandfather, John, who had been assigned to a firing squad during World War I. A major source of pride from his days as a veteran was that he was able to not kill while a member of that firing squad. He knew that the commands would be ready, aim, fire. And he knew that if he aimed at the prisoner on the command of aim, he would hit the target he was aiming at on the command of fire. His response was to aim slightly away from the prisoner on the command of aim, enabling him to miss when he pulled the trigger on the command of fire. My grandfather bragged for the rest of his life about outsmarting the army in this manner. Of course, others in the firing squad did kill the prisoner, but his conscience was clear. In the same way, generations of soldiers appeared to have either intentionally or instinctively outwitted the powers that be by simply exercising the soldier's right to miss. Another excellent example of soldiers exercising their right to miss is this mercenary journalist's account of going with one of Eden Pastora's, a.k.a. Comandante Zero, Contra units on an ambush of a civilian river launch in Nicaragua. I'll never forget Cerdo's words as he gave his imitation of a Pastora harangue prior to going into battle, telling the entire formation, "If you kill a woman, you're killing a Sandinista. If you kill a child, you're killing a Sandinista." And off we went to kill women and children. Once again, I was part of the 10 men who would actually perform the ambush. We cleared our fields of fire and settled back to await the arrival of women and children and whatever other civilian pastures there might be on this launch. Each man was alone with his thoughts. Not a word was spoken among us regarding the nature of our mission. Cerdo paced back and forth nervously, some yards behind us in the protection of the jungle. The loud throb of the powerful diesels of the 70-foot launch preceded its arrival by a good 2 minutes. The signal to commence fire was given as it appeared in front of us, and I watched the RPG-7 rocket arc over the boat and into the jungle on the opposite bank. The M60 machine gun opened up. I rattled off a 20-round burst from my FAL. Brass was flying as thick as the jungle insects as our squad emptied their magazines. Every bullet sailed harmlessly over the civilian craft. When Cerdo realized what was happening, he came running out of the jungle, cursing violently in Spanish and firing his AK rifle at the disappearing launch. Nicaraguan peasants are mean bastards and tough soldiers, but they're not murderers. I laughed aloud in relief and pride as we packed up and prepared to move out. Dr. John, America in Arde. Note the nature of such a conspiracy to miss. Without a word being spoken, every soldier who is obliged and trained to fire reverted, as millions of others must have over the centuries, to the simple artifice of soldierly incompetence. And like the firing squad member mentioned earlier, these soldiers took a great and private pleasure in outmaneuvering those who would make them do that which they would not. Even more remarkable than instances of posturing and equally indisputable is the fact that a significant number of soldiers in combat elect not even to fire over the enemy's head, but instead do not fire at all. In this respect, their actions very much resemble the actions of those members of the animal kingdom who submit passively to the aggression and determination of their opponent rather than fleeing, fighting, or posturing. We have previously observed General S.L.A. Marshall's findings concerning the 15-20% firing rates of U.S. soldiers in World War II. Both Marshall and Dyer note that the dispersion of the modern battlefield was probably a major factor in this low firing rate, and dispersion is indeed one factor in the complex equation of restraints and enabling mechanisms. Yet Marshall noted that even in situations where there were several riflemen together in a position facing an advancing enemy, only one was likely to fire while the others would tend to such tasks as running messages, providing ammo, tending wounded, and spotting targets. Marshall makes it clear that in most cases the firers were aware of the large body of non-firers around them. The inaction of these passive individuals did not seem to have a demoralizing effect on actual firers. To the contrary, the presence of the non-firers seemed to enable the firers to keep going. Dyer argues that all other forces on the World War II battlefield must have had somewhere near the same rate of non-firers. If, says Dyer, a higher proportion of Japanese or Germans were willing to kill, then the volume of fire they actually managed to produce would have been 3, 4, or 5 times greater than a similar number of Americans, and it wasn't. There is ample supporting evidence to indicate that Marshall's observations are applicable not only to U.S. soldiers, or even to the soldiers on all sides in World War II. Indeed, there are compelling data that indicate that this singular lack of enthusiasm for killing one's fellow man has existed throughout military history. A 1986 study by the British Defense Operational Analysis Establishment's Field Studies Division used historical studies of more than 119th and 20th century battles and test trials using pulsed laser weapons to determine the killing effectiveness of these historical units. The analysis was designed, among other things, to determine if Marshall's non-firearm figures were correct in other earlier wars. A comparison of historical combat performances with the performance of their test subjects, who were not killing with their weapons and were not in any physical danger from the enemy, determined that the killing potential in these circumstances was much greater than the actual historical casualty rates. The researchers' conclusions openly supported Marshall's findings, pointing to unwillingness to take part in combat as a major factor that kept the actual historical killing rate significantly below the laser trial levels. But we don't need laser test trials and battle reenactments to determine that many soldiers have been unwilling to take part in combat. The evidence has been there all along, if we had only looked.